the Bloomberg Manulife event, Is Your Neighborhood Fit to Live In? Featuring Dr. James Salas. I'm your host, Jill Barker, fitness columnist for the Montreal Gazette and proud member of McGill Athletics. After such a wonderful lecture we had last year by Dr. Stephen Blair, the inaugural winner of the Bloomberg Manulife Prize, it's no surprise we've got another full house here today. So thank you very much for all your interest. We also have a large remote audience who is watching this on the McGill webcast, so I welcome them as well. As a member of today's audience, not only do you benefit from such a great lecture, what you're going to be able to do is actually benefit from a dialogue with Dr. Salas as well. So we've got two of McGill's most inquisitive PhD candidates, students, who are going to be up on stage, and myself, and we'll be asking Dr. Salas some questions after his talk, and then we're going to turn the microphones over to you, the audience, and then you're more than welcome to ask questions. So get your pen and paper out and be ready, and we'll have about 10 minutes. We ask that you just limit yourself to one question. And before we start, I'd like to introduce Dr. Hélène Perrault, a clinical exercise psychologist and dean of the Faculty of Education and the driving force behind the Bloomberg Manulife Prize. Dr. Perrault.
Good morning, everyone. No, afternoon now, sorry. I'm just going to correct a little something here because Jill made me a psychologist, and I don't want to be talking psychology against you. I'm a physiologist, so a little bit of a difference here. It's so wonderful to have all of you here with us today for this annual event. As you know, this Bloomberg Manulife Prize for Active Health is an opportunity for us to come and exchange with some of the leaders in the area of exercise, active health, and health promotion. So the prize, as you know, was established in 2011, so now 2 years ago, by Mr. Lawrence Bloomberg and Manulife Financial. And the prize is based in our Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education here at McGill in the Faculty of Education. As you know, the goal for this prize is to recognize and reward some of North America's leading researchers in the areas of exercise science, physiology, psychology, nutrition, health promotion. And not only because they're leading researchers, but because they have been able to translate the findings of their research into impactful action and show the way for individuals to follow. So by giving such a prize, we are, with this initiative, bringing to the public some issues that may not otherwise be getting such an audience. Part of the prestige for this prize is also due to the fact that there is a very tough and select jury made up of individuals from all parts of Canada and the U.S. who bring complementary expertise in each of these areas. The jury, again, has met in June last year and has triaged and decided on the winner that you will meet here today. We're very happy to have a winner that is still maintaining very high bar as we had last year. But the Bloomberg Manulife Prize also targets the future of research, and it does so by supporting talent through doctoral fellowships. And the doctoral fellowships are for students who are registered in the program in the Department of Kinesiology and Physical Education and who are targeting research on active health. We have, again, this year, two very worthy doctoral students, and I'm very pleased to introduce them to you. I'm not sure if they're here. The first one is Hiram Cantu, and Hiram is a biomedical engineer graduate from the University of Monterrey in Mexico. He is working under the supervision of Dr. Julie Côté, who I see right here, Julie. And the project focuses on detecting and understanding the effects of fatigue in patients with Parkinson's disease. And the view is, of course, to enhance their ability to take part in an active life. The second recipient, don't know if he's here as well, William Falcao, no, native of Brazil. He completed a master's degree in sports psychology. He was at McGill and now doing his doctoral work to develop coaching techniques to promote positive lifestyles among youth and to promote health and education. So congratulations to you both. And wish them very best on their professional career. It's a nice start when you can have such support. And now, my great pleasure is to introduce this year's winner of the Bloomberg Manulife Prize, and it's Dr. James Salas. We're so grateful that he did take the opportunity to come and visit us, chose the coldest time of the year to come. You really wanted to see a difference, and we're really grateful that he did. Professor Salas is a distinguished professor of psychology in the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine at the University of California in San Diego. He's widely recognized as a leading expert in human behavior and its influence on physical activity and health determinants. He began his career investigating how to successfully encourage individuals to incorporate physical activity into their daily lives. Well, he quickly realized that while you could influence people to change and introduce exercise, physical activity in their life for a short while, it was not going to be lasting for very long. And I think we can all attest to that. But he didn't stop there, and he wanted to understand the root cause for this behavior. And so he started examining how technological advances or urban environments we live in, particularly the layout of our cities and the neighborhoods, make it easier or more difficult for us to adopt a healthy lifestyle. So amongst many of his achievements, because it would be too long to list them all, many achievements on the promotion for physical activity and health. He's particularly known for the Built Environment Assessment Training Institute. Now, through this institute that he initiated, he helped create a free online course that teaches researchers, policymakers, and others how to assess their local environment, including streetscapes, parks, trails, and to optimize the potential for physical activity and healthy lifestyle. He has and continues to present his findings to legislators and other policy leaders as part of an effort to affect policy change through evidence-based research. And in addition to all of this and his academic appointment at the University of California, he is the director of Active Living Research Program, which is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So he has been recognized with numerous awards, honors, including Distinguished Service Award from Society of Behavioral Medicine, Vice Presidency of the American College of Sports Medicine, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition. The role that our physical environment plays in our ability to adopt healthy lifestyle is one of the research areas in the field which had been neglected, completely or very much overlooked, and until recently when Dr. Salas opened the door and started examining these issues. And I'm sure you cannot wait to find out more about those kinds of issues. And so, Jim, please, thank you very much for being here with us.
Merci, bonjour, hello. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you all for coming and spending a bit of your afternoon with us. Certainly, it's a great honor to receive this prize. I referred to it as the Nobel Prize for Physical Activity. because it is the biggest prize for physical activity. And this is really good for the field because I hope to remind you how critical physical activity is for health. But the flip side of that is that we're doing much too little to help people be active. And so we have really high ambitions about how to get people active on a long-term basis. And I want to show you how some of our research, I think, is guiding the way for big changes, which I think are justified. So we're calling this talk. I want to say I've just been given a wonderful welcome. Everybody's been fantastic. And you even brought out special record weather for me. And I'll just say, well, really, you shouldn't have. So I'm doing my best here. It's a little contrast from California. But the people have been extraordinarily record warm. So that's a nice thing, too. So we're going to talk about, is your neighborhood fit to live in? But first, just a little bit of background here about, you know, the key topic here of physical activity. Hopefully, some of you were here last year to hear Stephen Blair talk. He's a very good longtime friend and really lays out the case for the extraordinary health effects of physical activity. And I see this as kind of a follow-up of, well, how can we get people active? So The Lancet is the most influential health journal in the world, and they had a special issue on physical activity for the first time to coincide with the London Olympics this year. And they concluded that inactivity is a pandemic, a worldwide epidemic. That has, you see, far-reaching health, economic, environmental, and social consequences. So let me give you some of the details behind that. These are data from the World Health Organization, and it's the leading causes of death. What we see here is that the top cause of death is high blood pressure, big problem, then tobacco smoke, tobacco use, then high blood glucose or diabetes, then the fourth leading cause of death is physical inactivity. Above things like diet, overweight and obesity, unsafe water, poor diet, alcohol, okay? Above all of those things. So it really is one of the critical health challenges of our time. But we are not getting, there's not as much effort being put into promoting activity as there is of controlling tobacco. And we know from the tobacco wars that it's hard to change these things. And it takes a lot of effort. It takes policy change. It takes economic changes. It takes a lot of effort. And so we need that in physical activity. And so how does physical activity kill all these people? By contributing to heart disease, type 2 diabetes, breast cancer, and colon cancer, among other things. And then there's quality of life with psychological issues, and then there's overweight and obesity. So it is a big issue. So it is most worthy of this prize and the attention that this is helping to draw to the problem of inactivity and the promise of promoting activity. According to the best data we have, which is maybe not all that good, at least 31% of adults are putting their health at risk around the world by not being active enough. And this is more than the percent of people who smoke. So it's a large number and maybe an underestimate of the problem. So now let's get into how can we think about activity? When most people think about physical activity, think about, I need to go out and exercise. And that's good, but that's not the only option. So we think about your ancestors, our ancestors, were active in every part of their life. And we've always had, like, we call them these domains of life. And oddly, it spells out sloth, doesn't it? Did you notice that? We call this the sloth model. And except for sleep, people historically have been active in all of these parts of life. Leisure activities in every culture has dance as part of their culture all over the world. Occupation, you know, work used to mean work, physical work, doing things, moving things, lifting things. Transportation. We used to use these out-of-date technologies called feet. Remember feet? That used to be transportation. And household used to mean doing actual work. You know, people had to wash clothes this way, clean their floors this way. You notice that this has all changed. We have invented technologies to eliminate or minimize activity in each and every one of these domains. We have systematically reduced activity, invented machines, invented technologies to take physical activity out of our lives. Because, frankly, most people didn't like sweeping the floors. They didn't like working very hard, digging ditches and lifting things. That wasn't the high point of their day. They wanted to say, let me invest in labor-saving devices. And in fact, all of us, think about how much money you have spent on devices that help you avoid physical activity. We want to avoid physical activity. We are motivated to avoid physical activity. So we need to realize that that's a fact. Just the same as we're motivated to seek out sugar and fat in our diet, we're motivated to avoid physical activity. So we have been successful. Leisure is now mostly in front of screens, especially for kids. Occupations, we spend our work mainly in front of screens. Transportation is now motorized. And household activity is eliminated by a household full of labor-saving devices. So our lifestyles have changed profoundly. And what we asked for, an activity-free lifestyle, we now have. We have achieved our goal, our historic goal of humankind to have easy lives. And so that should be perfect. Our lives should be perfect. Except now we're finding it's killing us. Just that one small problem. And it's not only killing us, it's killing our economies. Right? The chronic diseases that inactivity is part of, that's 80% of our health care cost. And those costs are rising around the world. And certainly in the United States, health care cost is driving our deficits, is driving our debt, and is really, so you can connect the big political problems in the U.S. to drivers of chronic diseases, with physical inactivity being chief among them. All right, and so this is happening all over the world. Diabetes is epidemic, obesity is epidemic, heart disease and cancers are rising, and in many parts of the world, they have no capacity to handle all of this. So this is the big picture. We've worked hard to eliminate activity, and we have done that, but now we are suffering the consequences of that that were not anticipated. So we can either go along in this same vein and continue taking activity out of our lives, or we can try something different. I'm going to suggest that we try something different. And, you know, I'm a psychologist, so when I was trying to figure out how can we get people to be more active, I thought how psychologists always thought. Well, we'll educate them on the benefits, and that's going to motivate them how to be active. And then we'll teach them skills so that they can set goals, monitor their progress, reward themselves when they achieve their goals. Problem solved. So I and many others went down this road, and we had some success. When we compare our theory-based interventions of motivating and people to be active, that's better than doing nothing. All right, it's better than not helping them at all. But then we're confronted with the limitations of this approach. You know, when we put on programs and research, we find that, well, most people don't want to be a part of a program. They'd rather stay at home, and even if they're motivated, they don't want to come out to a program. And those that do come, the changes are surprisingly modest, especially compared to the effort that we put in. And then, even when the people change, those changes are not long-lasting. And so this is not a recipe for solving a mass problem of inactive lifestyles. I just reminded myself, looking out and seeing everybody sitting and watching, it's a little ironic, isn't it? All right, so it's a foretaste of why we're focusing on the environment. So I will just invite you, my little intervention, if you want to get up and stand or pace on the sides as we're talking, feel free to do that. You have my permission. So, we're not changing the environment. We're not going to take away the chairs. We're not going to take away the tables. So my guess is most of you will continue to sit. All right? So what do we think are the root causes of low activity? Well, I'll cut to the chase and say we think it has to do with environment and policy, that we've designed our environments to encourage inactivity. This kind of room being an example. And if you think about children, not only do we fill the classrooms with chairs, but we insist, we have policies that they sit in them all the time, unless those few precious minutes that we send them out for recess and physical education. So just a couple of examples that you can relate to in this moment where we set up our environments for inactivity. But as a psychologist, I was never taught about the environment, so I had to learn about it. And our theories tell us to focus on the person and the social relationships. And those are important. But we also need to understand our environment, the places where we do activity, and the places which are designed to prevent us from doing activity. And then there's policies that affect some of these, and I'll get into some of those. So I'm showing you an ecological model. And ecology is the study of human ecology is the study of how people interact with their environment. So this is a new idea for psychology, a new idea for public health, an idea that we borrowed from biology. And now the promise of expanding our model beyond what I call psychological and social models is that if you change an environment and you change a policy, that affects everybody in that community or everybody in that jurisdiction, and on a relatively permanent basis. So that means if you get the environment and policy right, you can have a widespread, long-lasting effect on the positive side. If you get that environment and policy wrong, you've got a world of trouble. And my friends, I'm here to tell you, we got a world of trouble for physical activity. Okay, so now how do we think about I'm going to mainly talk to you about environments and policies because this is the new ideas. This is a new way of looking at physical activity. And are our neighborhoods fit to live in? Fit being meaning active. How do we think about environments and neighborhoods? So everything kind of revolves around the home. And we'll go back to our domains of activity. So first we'll think about community design. How can we design our communities to promote especially active travel? Well, if you design your communities based on policies that separate uses, and that's what zoning policies do, they separate uses so that houses are here, shops and commercial areas are here, and office parks are somewhere else. If you design your community environment that way, then you have to drive from place to place. Everything is so far apart. You cannot walk. Those policies and environments take away the option of walking from place to place. So that's about having destinations nearby. That's what we want. And then schools and work sites. You can look at them in a number of ways. Where are the schools? Where are the work sites? Are they within walking or biking distance to the people they serve? And are they situated in a way that if they are close enough, are they served by public transit? Are they served by bicycle facilities? And then the design. So if you're an architect, do you design when people walk in, the first thing they see is a beautifully designed elevator, and they have to walk to the rear of the building, find the stairs, find a way inside them, and try to overcome the smell of the cleaning supplies that are stored in the stairwell? Or do you design buildings so that you walk in the front door, you see a very inviting, open, beautifully designed stairwell inviting you to take the stairs? And if you want to take the elevator, you can find it, but it's at the other end of the building. It's kind of in the corner, and it's not marked. All right, that's how you can design buildings differently. Okay, so now let's think about how can we promote active recreation. Well, people need places where they can walk and jog and play and play soccer and hockey and all of those things. And parks and recreation then becomes our friend of physical activity. And you see a playground here. What if you live in a neighborhood where there's no playground? Where do your children play? Do you have to drive them to a place across town? Do you have to pay to take them to a class because there's nowhere in their neighborhood that they can play? So, and then the transportation system. The transportation system is actually important for transportation and recreation. Because the most common recreational activity is walking. The most common place that people do that is in their neighborhood. So if you have sidewalks and trails in your neighborhood, then that can really encourage you to make it easy for you to take a walk or a bike ride or a run. If you don't have a sidewalk, if you don't have trails, then you're kind of on your own to figure out, well, what can I do? And of course, a transportation system can be set up to be fantastic for driving. And in the U.S., the stated policy of our transportation system is to move as many cars as we can as fast as possible. And we've invested trillions of dollars to accomplish that. The unintended consequence of that, we have a transportation system that kills about 15,000 pedestrians and bicyclists a year and makes it very uncomfortable, inconvenient, and unsafe to walk and bike on public roads, or many of them. So the transportation system can be your friend or enemy for physical activity. But anyway, this is what we think about for an active living community. Now, this is about research, so let me show you some of the research. But before you do the research in this area, you need partners. Because, I'm going to go back. Because one of the things that all of these places have in common is that the public health department is in charge of none of them. Public health does not make any decisions about community design, parks and recreation, transportation, schools, or architecture. Yet, the people who do make decisions about those places affect health. We in public health and we as taxpayers pay the consequences, pay for the consequences of what turn out to be not so good decisions in these areas. All right? So it's not that people, that planners and transportation people have the intent to harm health, but now we're learning that the decisions that have been very common in these fields are harming health. All right, so we need to work with the planners, the transportation engineers, the park and rec people, the landscape architects, educators, and architects. Those need to be our partners, our new friends in public health, and so we can work together. All right, so now we talk about walkable communities where you can walk for destinations, walk to shopping, walk to your job, walk to school. And here's a picture of a walkable neighborhood. Now, this could be Old Town, the old part of Montreal. It isn't. You know, this is a place in the Czech Republic. But here's the secret. Every city built before, let's say, the 1930s or 40s, is a walkable city. Every neighborhood built before the 30s and 40s is a walkable neighborhood. Why? Because they were built for walking and there were no cars or very few cars. All right, so that's why in older cities, you always find walkable places. And hopefully you haven't torn them down. And you have not in Montreal, which is good. So they're mixed use. Mixed use means you don't separate residential, commercial, and office. You put them together. They're mixed. And so here we have shops along the bottom and residences along the right above. So everybody has access. Here's the new way, the modern way. Is it a smart way of building our cities? I think we now would say it's probably not that smart. And so which is better for walking? Ask this guy over here on the right. Is this a good place for walking? I feel so sorry for this poor fellow. You know, he can't be enjoying that. And he's very likely to get run over. So you see, all the planning is for cars. Cars can go fast here. And look at this. In this wide shot, I can still only get half of the road. That's only half of the asphalt. And there's absolutely no planning for pedestrians. None whatsoever. So which is more aesthetically pleasing, A or B? Which do you think is going to last longer as a way of building, A or B? Well, I think it's going to be A. A is going to win on aesthetics. We know already that A is winning on economics. People pay more to be in a mixed use place. This is not really that desirable. Okay. And then, of course, there's the suburban residential areas, right? So a lot of asphalt there. It's built for cars. You can see where the cars go in there. But if you look closely, you can also see that for some people, they're doing recreation here because there's basketball hoops. Okay, so but in this neighborhood, there's nowhere you can walk to unless you're going to walk all day long. Okay. So let's go about how do we research this. So I just want to tell you, give you snapshots of a few of our studies. This is the neighborhood quality of life study that we did led by myself, Brian Salins, who's a health psychologist, Lawrence Frank, who's a city and transportation planner, now across your country at University of British Columbia. We designed the study to study the effects of walkability on total physical activity. So we selected neighborhoods that were low and high on walkability. So I showed you pictures of low and high walkability. Also, low and high on socioeconomic status, so we could see if low or high income related to this equation. So we selected neighborhoods that fit all of these criteria. We studied about 2,000 people. These are adults in this study in the Baltimore, Maryland area and the Seattle, Washington area. We measured physical activity by putting accelerometers around their waist. And these are electronic devices, kind of like a very smart pedometer. And they wore them up to 2 weeks. So every minute of every day, we knew how active they were. So it's a real measure of movement. And what you see here, in the green bars, it shows more physical activity in the high walkable neighborhoods than the low walkable neighborhoods. We saw the same pattern for lower income and higher income. And this is about 3 to 5 minutes per day of measured physical activity. And that's, of course, 35 to 50 minutes a week. Which means, on average, just by living in a walkable neighborhood, you're going to meet the 30-minute-per-day guideline at least one day more per week. So that's a big effect, applying to not just participants, volunteers to a program, but everybody that lives there. And not just for the 3 months that you're in a program, but for the 20 or 30 years that you might live there. So this is showing the power of the environment, affecting a lot of people over a long period of time. And if you're doing this much activity, and think about how much activity this would be over a year and over 20 years, that might be enough calories burned to help you be less overweight and obese. And that's kind of what we found. You see here, the green bars for walkable neighborhoods are lower rates of obesity and overweight than in the low walkable neighborhoods. And again, we saw similar patterns for lower income and higher income, which is good news because in lower income populations tend to have higher rates of obesity, as you can see here, and higher rates of chronic disease. Okay, so this was very encouraging for us. So we said, well, that's adults. What about people in other ages? So we did a similar study with adolescents. We found the same thing. We found 5 to 7 minutes difference, more activity in the higher walkable neighborhoods, evaluating them in the same way. And we found that they walked to school 1 to 1.5 more days per week. So we did another study with older adults, and we found basically the same thing. They did more physical activity in more walkable neighborhoods. And we did the same thing with children. So we're finding that that walkable neighborhood seems to work for everybody, no matter your age, no matter your economic status. So we said, well, we've just been studying the U.S. There's a whole rest of the world. Is this specific to the U.S.? Because our cities are so unwalkable that if you give people a little bit of a chance, you know, they walk, but it doesn't really matter elsewhere. We said, well, let's find out. So, and of course, places look different, you know, in different countries. In Atlanta, another example of they're not planning for pedestrians. Yeah, they just push people right out into the middle of the traffic there. And whereas in this in Belgium here, it's a pedestrian street. They're thinking only of pedestrians. And look at that. You've got walkers, cyclists, strollers, dogs, everybody. Everybody's coming out, and they're enjoying it. It's a great day, a beautiful place. They probably didn't do this for health reasons. They're really doing this to attract people to the shops that are along these walkable streets so they can spend more money. Okay, and we did a study in 11 different countries, including Canada, every continent almost, and we asked them 7 questions, the same in all these countries, and if the dot is above the horizontal line, that means that this feature helped these people be more active. So having shops near home, that's mixed use. Having transit. Transit is active transportation because you have to walk to and from your stop. Sidewalks were important. Facilities for bicycling and parks. And if the more of these features you had in your neighborhood, the more likely you were to be active. And so if you had all 6 of these built environment features, then you were twice as likely to be active as somebody who did not have any of those features. So this is a really big effect of the environment on physical activity. And we found this, again, we found this to be true across all of these different countries. And so we are doing yet another international study we call IPAN, or the International Physical Activity and Environment Network. We have now 12 countries that have completed their study. We're just starting to analyze the data. And in these 12 countries, we have objectively measured built environments using geographic information systems, so we have a lot of detail, and we have the accelerometers, so we have really strong measures. So, and you can see that even though we tried to, Let me see if I can show you. Well, you see the United States here, this one. So we tried to have a big difference between the low and high walkability, but you see it's not much difference when you compare it to places in Europe and South America, and especially to Hong Kong. Look at Hong Kong. It looks like it's from a different planet there. And this is residential density. So we have a lot more range, a lot more variation we're going to be able to study. So we think that's going to be really important. Okay, I want to end just by emphasizing a few solutions. How can we go from killing people, from inactivity, to creating places that can help people experience the joy of being active? Parks. Parks are very important. And so we know that people who live near parks are more likely to use them and are more likely to be physically active. So here's an example. In Boulder, Colorado, they made their main street pedestrian only, and they went a step further and built a park, built a playground right in the center of the street. And look at that. It's just a few rocks and things, but kids are having a great time, and they're active there. So parks are very important. Activity-friendly transportation systems. All right, we call this a complete street. That means it's designed to be effective for pedestrians, for bicyclists, and for drivers, and to have transit nearby. And so now we have pedestrians walking on the bike paths, all right? So, it'd be better to have a bicyclist in that shot. And so there's examples all over the world. This example is from Bogota, Colombia, which surprisingly is a real leader in promoting activity through environmental design. Here's how we do it in the U.S., okay? Yeah, we'll have a sidewalk for a little while, but we figure you're going to get tired of walking, so we'll just take the sidewalk away. Or look at this. Look at if you don't plan for people walking, look what you're doing. Who wants this? This is terrible. Put a kid at risk. Okay, I'm about finished with my time, but I want to show you this, to show you the potential power of doing things right in the environment. The green line is the percent of people who walk, bike, or take transit for transportation, the percent of trips by active transportation. You can see that U.S. is the worst. Canada is not that much better. And then European countries are doing, look how different they're doing it. They've got some above 50% of all trips, active transportation. And then look at the red line. You notice they're going in opposite directions? This is obesity, all right? The countries with the lowest active travel have the highest obesity. The countries that do the most active travel have the lowest obesity. Coincidence? Maybe, maybe not. This is not a randomized controlled trial, but it's pretty compelling evidence. So look at those differences there. This is the power of environmental change. And here's a piece of good news. Cities around the world, here are a few, that started out with 1% of travel by bicycle. All of these cities decided we're going to do a lot of things to promote bicycling. It's not going to be just bike paths. It's not going to be just bike share. It's not going to be just education. It's not going to be just policy change and encouragement. It's going to be all of those things. And look at this. All of them increased, including cities like yours. And I like to point out Minneapolis. Minneapolis, they quadrupled their bicycling in a city that you think would not be be good for bicycling. And so I know that you've promoted bicycling here. I'd be happy to hear if somebody's got data on that. So what I like to point out is in terrible weather, Minneapolis, they do 4 times as much bicycling as we do in perfect weather, San Diego. So if you were thinking it's all the weather, it's not. It's policy and environment change. So I just want to say, put out one little thing about PE, physical education, that's part of policy and environment change. Look at the top picture. That's what a lot of PE is that we have in the U.S. Not very active, is it? Look at the bottom. That's much more active. Kids are having more fun. And so I just want to end by saying we know how to improve physical education. Our SPARK program started out as a research study. We showed that we got a lot of positive outcomes out of physical education, and now we're disseminating that program. It's being used in many thousands of schools across the U.S. and getting at least 1.5 million kids active every day. So we know how to get people active. And now it's a matter of putting that into practice. So as a concerned citizen, what can you do? One is, of course, be active yourself. 30 minutes physical activity every day. It can be walking. Make it something you like. Do it with friends. So what can you do to help your city become more activity friendly? Get informed. Learn the research. Go to our Active Living Research website, which I'll show you in a moment. Join with others, an advocacy group, or start an advocacy committee make sure every neighborhood has parks, every neighborhood has sidewalks in your community, and speak up. Don't just sit there. Speak up often. Go to the city council. Get to know your city councilors. Get to know your national representatives. Write an op-ed, a letter to the editor, or a blog. And so I'll end just by inviting you to come to our Active Living Research website. There's a lot of information there. You can see the materials along the bottom. They're for non-scientists, right? Summarizing the research for non-scientists. Share those with your elected representatives. Be active, and thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much. That was a great lecture. And I just want to also pitch this website, which I've looked at, and there's a lot of great material there, a lot of great information, and a lot of information on the advocacy. So if that's what you're interested in, please do visit. Now I'm just going to take the time. We're going to have our students and Dr. Salas are going to take their seat in the chairs, and I am going to introduce the rest of our panel. So Jeff Carroll is a PhD candidate in sports psychology and a beneficiary of last year's Bloomberg Manulife Fellowship. His research is focused on how the psychological symptoms of concussions impact an individual's well-being and quality of life. Tamara Carver is a PhD candidate in the Department of Physical Education and Kinesiology, and her research involves work with obese individuals before and after bariatric surgery. So just to go over again what we'll be doing, we're going to take our seats. Tamara's going to start with the first question, followed by Jeff, and if there's time, myself, and then I'll be turning over the questions to the audience. We'll just get started.
So Dr. Salas, thank you for your informative, inspiring talk. In your presentation, you highlighted the importance of parks and recreation. So I was wondering if you could share with us your opinion on this new concept and implementation of outdoor public exercise equipment that we see in Beijing, Israel, now parts of the USA. Mm-hmm. And in your opinion, are these initiatives part of the solution for making neighborhoods more fit?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. You're well informed about the latest activities. And happily, I can give you a little more than opinion.
Great.
Our Active Living Research Program funded an evaluation of these exercise equipment. They called them family fitness zones, mm-hmm. In several parks in Los Angeles, in low-income areas. And what they found was that in about half the parks, that having that equipment there brought in more people to use the equipment and also lifted the level of activity in the whole park. So that was good. It really attracted people that wanted to be active. It gave them a chance to be active. In half of them, half of the places where they put them in, it didn't have such a big effect. It was kind of very modest, but the results were encouraging enough
that the sponsor that paid for this said, okay, we're going to expand this program from 10 parks to 70 parks and do this around the country. So, you know, to me, this is an example of the power of research. You know, now that they have the evaluation of that, we say, well, this is working. This is a good idea. Let's do a lot more of it. And that's what we want to do with our research and the research that we funded through Active Living Research. And let me expand on this just a little bit and mention something they do also more in other countries than in the U.S., but there's actually a body of research in Latin America about having exercise classes in public places like parks and plazas and squares, and it's very common. And the research shows that it really attracts people to be more active. So this is really good. And this evaluation has led the Brazilian government to devote $1 billion to expanding that exact program across the whole country, which is like it's several hundred million people. It's a big country. And it's something we're learning, because now there's a project going in San Diego where they're trying to bring this concept to the U.S. from Latin America and evaluate it and see how we can make it work in our place. But I want to tell you, I have to just tell you a counter argument. This sounds like a perfect idea, easy to do, but it may not be so easy. I get the Los Angeles newspaper, and on the front page about 2 weeks ago, there was an article about people in Santa Monica, which is right on the beach, complaining about how many people were exercising in the public park right above the beach. So, well, they're too noisy. There's just too many of them. What? Complaining about the number of people exercising. And this was on the same day that a study was released showing that Americans had the worst health of any developed country. All right? So you think, well, who could object to people exercising in a park? Well, you might be surprised. So that's why we need people in favor of these kinds of changes to speak up. So there you go. That's probably a lot more than
perfect. You
wanted.
Dr. Salas, thinking back to your slide that you had on sloth, the transportation aspect kind of hit home with me. And I know people in Montreal, we bike a lot, we walk a lot, but traffic safety is always a concern. From a first-hand point of view, I'm someone who walks and bikes to school every day, either for, sometimes I'll go on run, sometimes I'll walk, for transportation or activity.
Yeah.
But there's always that concern about traffic safety. Maybe could you touch on a bit about that? Is traffic safety a barrier to living an active lifestyle and being physically active?
Traffic safety is one of the biggest barriers to an active lifestyle. It's well documented. I mentioned how many pedestrians and bicyclists are killed. Well, that means that concern is justified. And you need to think twice. Okay, is my plan for walking, is that place going to be safe or not? We did a study several years ago about walking to school or walking and biking to school. And, of course, there's not much of that in the U.S. And what we found was that there was much less of it in the low walkable neighborhoods, which is kind of ironic, because that's the suburbs, and people move to the suburbs because they think, well, that's going to be a better place for my kid. But the biggest barrier to allowing their children to walk and bike was concern about traffic safety. That it's not safe to cross the streets, the school is on a busy street, so that it's kind of ironic, right? So it's one of the things behind the reduction in walking and biking to school. Another thing that we've learned, especially from bicycling research, is that Bicyclists think about their route. You know, which way am I going to go, right? And they found the most important decision factor is where will I be safest from traffic? And you might think they would want to take the shortest route. That's important, but not as important. Or they might want to avoid hills. That's important, but not as important. It's trying not to get killed. One of my favorite studies about bicycling is they put GPS devices on, they gave them to bicyclists who commute for work. And they found, this was in Portland, Oregon, where they'd done a lot of investment to make good bicycle facilities. And they found that the more that a street was protected from cars, the more the bicycles used it. So if it was a street with no protection, the only people that went on that were the young guys in Lycra, right? The daredevils. And if there was a painted stripe, people would use that more. But if there was a separation, like you have here in Montreal that I have seen, it's separated so the cars don't want to hit the bicyclists, then many more people rode there, especially women. So they found that women were particularly sensitive to the safety issue. So to me, that's it's an indicator of whether you're successful in your bicycle system if you've got a lot of women riding bicycles. And so they presented these data to the city council in Portland. Right? So, and the city council said, well, we've been investing in these facilities for a long time, and you have now proven to us with GPS devices that our investments are working. So we're now going to triple our investments in bicycling here in Portland. Again, another value of research. Thanks for the question.
So how do we change the existing footprint of our communities that were built generally for cars to be more walkable?
Okay, now, you had to ask me that question, didn't you? This is the hardest one. And I'm going to, you know, the first part of that answer to me is we need to change the way we do business when we're building new places, right? I'm certainly convinced that low walkable, suburban style, automobile oriented neighborhoods are not good for health. And we've kind of shown it for every age group. So the first thing is quit making more of them. In the US, the studies show that people are moving out of the suburbs. Young people find them boring. They want to be in a walkable neighborhood where they can go to the coffee shops and meet their friends. Older people find them constricting. You know, they don't want to drive or they can't drive anymore, so they're going to be homebound. So they don't. But if they were when older people are in a walkable neighborhood, they can get around, right? So the demand for walkable neighborhoods is going up, but the policies and the practices of real estate and the banking industry and home loans is driving continued development in an unwalkable manner. So that the first thing I would do is let's stop making more of this because there's plenty. Flying into even Montreal, people think walkable, bikeable Montreal, yes, in the center, but what about all the rest? Maybe not so walkable. So what can be done with what you already have? And there's no good answer because, you know, the unwalkable residential neighborhoods, not much you can do to change that because there's the roads, there's the sewer underneath, there's the water pipes. But a few things you can do. So along the arterial routes, the busy streets, a lot of communities are redeveloping those. They're taking down the strip malls and they're putting up walkable developments. They're putting up mixed-use buildings, shops on the bottom, so you still have the retail, and then offices and residents above. And then slowing down the traffic, all right, so that it becomes more neighborhood-like. So it remains, you know, these corridors can remain commercial, but you spread the commercial out. And so then people living on either side, all up and down there, have better access to commercial. And that becomes kind of a center of a walkable neighborhood. So that's one thing. The other thing is, all across the U.S., the performance of a lot of shopping malls is declining. So they just take them down, and they can build an entire walkable neighborhood where one mall used to be, reconnect it to the community, and there's a lot of examples of not only success from the point of view of, you know, changing and having a different environment, but economic success too. Revitalizes the whole area, makes it more desirable, the businesses do better, and even in California, this has transformed whole towns and cities. So there's some examples.
Great, thank you. Well, that's it for our questions. So now we'd love to have the audience participate as well. So the microphone is right here at the front. Again, we ask that you keep your questions to one. And away we go.
Hi. My name is Marianne Hatsopoulou. I'm an assistant professor in transportation engineering at McGill. I have a quick question, but first I do want to make a comment that recently I was at the annual meeting of the Transportation Research Board in Washington, D.C., and for the first time in many, many years, there was actually a workshop on transportation and public health. This is a meeting that groups traffic analysts, intelligent transportation system specialists, and there's a new subcommittee on transportation and public health. So I think people get it. People are starting to get it. I'm going to ask you a more classical question, and I'm sure you've heard that many, many times. How do you account for self-selection in residential location decisions in the sense that people who are already inclined to walk and bike will choose to live in central neighborhoods, and people who don't want to walk and bike would still want that patch of grass and that barbecue and want to stay in the suburbs?
Yep, okay, good, a good one. And so this is a very, certainly a common criticism of the studies that we do, because unlike medical and drug studies, you cannot easily do randomized controlled trials. You cannot assign people, okay, this table, you move to community A, and this table, you move to community B. Okay? Doesn't happen. And you can't tell community A, we're going to randomize you to completely renovate your whole city. And community B, you don't do anything. You can't do those kinds of studies. So most of the studies are cross-sectional. So they're open to the criticism, as you just described, that people who like walking go to a walkable community. People who like driving go to a driving-oriented community. So it's a good point. And two answers to that. One is there's quite a few studies that have tried to deal with that in a somewhat statistical way. They ask people, why did you move to this community? And they might give a lot of different reasons. It's a big, I like the house, it's the right color, it's good schools, it's a nice place to walk, it has good freeway access. And so then you look at the people who said, well, I moved here because I like to walk, all right? And then you kind of statistically adjust for that. And so some of the things that we're finding is, of course, some people do move to walkable communities because they want to be able to walk to the store, they want their kids to walk school. But what we find typically is if you statistically adjust for that, you still see a significant effect of the neighborhood. Over and over, we have many studies that show this, and in our Active Living Research website, we have a non-technical summary of those studies. And so what some of the studies show is actually a lot of people do want to move to a walkable neighborhood, but there aren't enough walkable neighborhoods in the U.S., so they have to move to the suburbs. And even with those people, they walk less than they would if they had moved to a walkable neighborhood. But if you want to live in a drivable neighborhood, you can do that. There's plenty of those. But if for some reason maybe your spouse wants to live in a walkable neighborhood, we find that people who love to drive, they keep driving in a walkable neighborhood. It doesn't make them walk. But if you want to walk and you live in a low walkable neighborhood, it prevents you from walking for transportation. It takes away your choice. So the way I look at it, walkable neighborhoods give you the choice of walking or driving, right? So that's one thing. Just very quickly, there's a brand new study that just came out from Australia where they followed people prospectively. Some of them moved into low walkable neighborhoods. Some of them moved into higher walkable neighborhoods. And the ones that moved to a higher walkable neighborhood were more active. The ones that moved to a lower walkable neighborhood than previously became less active. So this is from Billy Giles Cortai in Perth, Australia. You can look that up. Just came out. So I think the conclusion, I think the best conclusion right now is that the neighborhood where you live does make a difference in how active you are, how obese you are, and we're getting closer to being able to state definitively it's causal. We're not quite there yet.
Great.
Thank you. I am Sophie Kahawish, architect and planner. Thanks for McGill to have this dialogue. And really, we appreciate to be talking to you and the group. As you know, as all of us know, that after the first industrial revolution, the human being is suffering a lot, especially the architecture, when the school of French started to promote Beaux-Arts, the beauty of the buildings, and the planning also follow this theory. Until now, we are suffering about the beauty of everything without looking for the health or safety of ourselves and the environment. You had proved that in your study that the old cities are one of the wonderful experience we have to look at it and to analyze. And just maybe 1 hour ago, you mentioned your visit to Kuwait, and I really was in Kuwait working 30 years as experience. They have a wonderful old city with a fence around, with the courtyards, with the material used for the walls and the roofs, with mud, and they have like a back there, like a chimney for ventilation to reduce the temperature 6 or 7 degrees. Once the wealth is coming, they start to destroy this history, this beauty, this healthy environment by to allow the car the priority for using the car to have streets. If, as you see, as you told us before, that you look for the old city, you didn't find it. You find the streets, highways, and so on. So I think it is time to look for the history of old cities in order to understand how they developed the previous experience, which we postpone it and start modernization according to the Industrial Revolution, and so on.
Sorry, we have a question.
I think it is time now, according to what I have seen from your real smart study, which attracted me personally, that it is time to look or to change our educational system, not only in the universities, but in the associations and communities and so on. And really to add in the curriculum of the universities who have curriculums for urban design which never look for the needs of health, as you mentioned, for having pedestrian, having parks, and so on. So this has to be changed, and many of your objectives has to be added to the courses. This is the first step to start.
Okay, well, maybe I will thank you. Thank you for that. And, I think you're being heard by some of the academic leaders here at McGill. And I've heard that there's a lot of interest in doing interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary programs and studies, and that's what's absolutely needed. Let's be realistic. When we're talking about changing the design of communities, when we're thinking about changing our priorities in transportation, these affect giant industries. These affect the ways of doing things that people who are invested in the status quo may like to keep the same. Just like the people that complained about people exercising in the park, there's people who are pretty satisfied with spending half of their life in traffic. They seem to like that. Creating change is difficult, and universities can be catalysts for this and can be a part of doing things in a smarter way, creating environments that are going to help people be more active and healthier instead of standing in their way of doing such. So this is a challenge to universities. It's a challenge to governments to have the departments work together. But when big changes have been made, that's what has happened. The departments have worked together. And I will point you to New York City as a great example of that. They have about 10 of their city departments. They work together all the time and come together for a summit every year, 10 commissioners, to talk about how they're making improvements every year. So this can be done, but it's very difficult. But in my view, we have a choice. We can continue to do things like we are and create suburban neighborhoods and invest 90% of our transportation money into cars, and the consequence of that is we continue to have rising chronic disease and healthcare costs. Or we can do things better to promote physical activity, design walkable neighborhoods, protect bicyclists, and through that get people more active and hopefully start chipping away at our healthcare costs.
Hear, hear. Great. We're really short of time, so that's it for our questions for today. And I'd like to reintroduce Dean Perrault, who's going to thank, and I do thank Dr. Salas for the great presentation today, and all of you for coming and providing questions.
Wow. Okay, what can I add? Do thank you, Jim. Thank you for inspiring talk, for giving us a lot of food for thought. Certainly, lots of ideas, lots of things I think we can do individually and collectively. Thank you for that. I also do want to say that when we invite people at McGill, we really want to maintain the relationship with these people. We were going to think about you, but we want you to think about us. Now, a couple of nights ago in Toronto, we presented Dr. Salas with a McGill hat, mitts, scarf, you know, the whole thing. We knew he was coming to Montreal. But I know you're not going to wear them in San Diego and thinking of us. So I thought maybe a T-shirt.
Okay.
That'd be nice.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Let's see.
I also am going to ask perhaps Jeff and Tamara and Jill to join us for a group picture here. I want to thank you, Jill, really, for taking the lead and accepting to do this as a second year in a row. Thank you, Jill. It's been marvelous. Students, thank you for coming and taking part in this with us.
Sure, sure, sure. Maybe with this way, right?
That's right.
Where do we you got to see what's on this side. Enough talk. Action. Action. Get moving.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here.
See you next year.
Yes, very nice. Good job. Yes. You guys are brave.